Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Understood. California. Good afternoon. This is Mike Vandervoort on Drive-Thru HR. I'm at the SHRM Talent Conference in Orlando, and we're doing an odd time show today at 3:30 in the afternoon, and we have four guests, which is a large number, a live room. Our guests have just completed a panel on the top 12 trends in talent acquisition. There was a lot of tweeting from that conference, and I think it stimulated a lot of conversation. So if you wouldn't mind, I'm just going to have each one of our guests do a quick bio. So this, first up is Tom from SHRM.
Thank you, Michael. Tom Darrow, out of Atlanta, Georgia. Have an executive search firm called Talent Connections, and I'm serving as chair of the board of the SHRM Foundation.
Nice. Great. And Tony?
Sure. It's Tony Lee, and I'm VP of editorial at SHRM and have spent about 30 years following the talent acquisition field.
Awesome. And Peter Weddle?
Peter Weddle, I'm the CEO of TA Tech, which is the Association for Talent Acquisition Solutions. We're the trade organization for job boards, social media sites, aggregators, recruitment advertising agencies, ATS vendors, and so forth, helping to promote better performance for employers and recruiters.
And we also have Daniel Monahan from Amazon. Daniel, you want to tell us quickly about yourself?
Well, I think you've said it all.
What's your role at Amazon?
So from Seattle, I have our talent acquisition organization for the consumer business.
Okay, great. Okay, so earlier, like at 2:45 this afternoon, we finished this panel. I was an observer and did some tweeting, so you can check that out at SHRM, hashtag SHRM Talent, on Twitter. And it was a very interesting panel, a lot of discussion about the top trends in talent acquisition that SHRM and some of these folks are seeing today. And I will say I was struck. Some were, I was like, well, duh, you know, because they weren't really revelations, but I think that conversation behind them was interesting. And one of the first duh ones was that strong company branding is critical, right? So like, who doesn't know that? But the reality is it's a thing that companies struggle with. Not everybody gets it right. So I don't know. Does somebody want to?
Actually, Danielle took the lead in the panel. Do you want to? You want to talk a little bit about branding?
Well, I really told the story about our situation, being sort of a head-down, customer-focused company, not out there a lot, just focusing on delivering and innovating for our customers. When the New York Times article hit, and certainly, you know, being the learning company that we are, we took it to heart and looked into it. But I think that was a moment for us to think about, you know, we've got a great product brand. Are we doing enough to evangelize our employee brand? And so that was the story. And now a year later, we're in a very, very different place.
And you mentioned on the panel that you were named one of the top companies to work for. U.S., which is a pretty, I mean, you know, the list, and that's the Fortune list, right? The Fortune 100 list or otherwise?
It's actually recently in Forbes.
In Forbes.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. So it's not easy. I worked for a couple of those companies, and it's hard to attain, and it's even harder, I think, to sustain.
Yes.
So congratulations on that. From a brand point of view, and this isn't really something you guys talked about on the panel, so I don't want to like throw you in, you know, but there's three kinds of branding, it seems to me, if you go in a real high level. There's branding that you mentioned where you talk to employees. So there's your employment brand, and then there's your sort of your customer facing brand, and then there's sort of in the middle of the conversation, like maybe with a Slack or Yammer, talking to your employees internally. And then I thought, Peter, you raised a really interesting point tangentially with, you know, re-recruiting, right? So it's not just onboarding or your candidate experience and how you onboard your people and how they live with you during your career, there, however long that may be. But now you're saying you even got to think about maybe how those people talk about you after they leave, or do they come back like boomerang employees, right?
Well, right. The point I made about re-recruitment is that, you know, the best talent have options. They're often employed, and what that means is that after they have said yes, they go through a 2 or 4 week period of vulnerability where they can get a counteroffer from their current employer, they can get recruited away by another recruiter. It seems to me that the good old days of the recruiting process ending once a person says yes and then gets handed off to HR for onboarding are really gone, because the talent marketplace is such that we need to add a step, which I think is best described as re-recruitment. Really, your options there are only limited by your imagination. One example that I threw out was that you might provide to each person who said yes the ID and password to their own homepage on your corporate site, so that when they got back home after their final interview, after they said yes, whatever the situation was, and they opened up that homepage, there was a personal message from the CEO saying, "Welcome to our team." And then every day over the next 2 or 4 weeks, they got a constant stream of messages, not onboarding them, but re-recruiting them from their future colleagues and coworkers saying, "Gee, you made the right decision. We can't wait for you to get here."
Yeah. It's really important if you recruit globally, where people have 2 or 3 month notice period.
Right.
So I think then...
The contracts, like European employment contracts and stuff. Yeah, that's right.
And even in the 2 months notice.
Really? Mm-hmm. I didn't do much work. I worked for some European owned companies, and I remember, announcements that said like in 6 months,
right,
a new CHRO will take over. And I was like, what? That's very common. It is a lot different. You cracked me up, Tom, during the, you used the word, I think it was pitiful several times. So I was like, I don't know how I can retweet that. But anyway, so first of all, what do you think is pitiful? You had a couple of points that you hit on. So what are people struggle with a little bit? And then what do you think they could do better with that?
Well, I think it first came up in the employee referral program talk where, I kind of stated, and we were talking about how that's a strategic, sourcing initiative, obviously, for a company.
You actually said, I think it could be one of the most important strategies that an employer has, potentially, right?
I mean, the way I look at it is hiring is the most important thing a company does, and an employee referral program is the most important hiring initiative.
Right.
So therefore, it's the most important program in the company,
right,
if you look at it that way. And yet they do it pitifully, a lot of companies, right?
And is that because of the amounts they offer, or because it's just sort of like casually handled?
It's a lot. There, I mean, I've worked for CEOs that felt like, people said this should just be something they should do, right? I mean, gee, we should all want to, hire our friends and family. And that sounds nice, but in reality, unless somebody has a really good, you have to really get out there and dig and find people. And so I think the main point was to try to incent whatever that looks like, is it cash? Is it, trips? Is it drawings? I mean, there are even things in
cards
your performance
at the
review.
Amazon store.
Yeah. Comments in your performance review.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Recognition at a company meeting that, hey, welcome our new CHRO or whoever. And by the way, they were referred by so and so, right? Recognize them in front of all the employees of the company.
Mm-hmm.
One company I worked at, we had a logo that was specifically designed for the employee referral program. When somebody referred someone that got hired, they got a check, also got a shirt. We were a casual environment, a software environment. And they said, sure. Well, when you saw somebody around the office wearing that shirt with that logo, you knew that they had referred somebody that got hired. So you would say, oh, well, who'd you refer that got hired? I mean, it was an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. It was almost a prideful thing that people would wear that in the office to show that, hey, I'm going above and beyond. So
last night we had dinner over here at the Dolphin, I guess, the Swan rather. And I took an Uber home with other people. We were going to different places, and the Uber driver was like on his first week of work, right? And one of the guys that was riding us was from the Palo Alto area. And he was like, did you get a referral? Because, you can make more money. He was like all hustle and the guy was like, didn't even use his code. And the guy in the back seat was like, so it was really funny. And then he says, and then as he was leaving, when he dropped off, he said, sign up with Lyft. I'll give you a referral and you can double it. So he had this whole strategy of how to monetize Uber, which brings me, Tony, to a question. You guys were talking about the gig economy, right? That's like millennials, which you also mentioned. Millennials in the gig economy are like too hot button. There's like rules that are really important, or let's just stop that conversation because it's already old. I'm kind of put in both camps, I guess.
Yeah.
But with the gig economy, right? So there's challenges recruiting. You know, I do labor relations and I listen to you guys, like the Amazon story, right? I mean, there's labor relations implications to the brand. And if you get in a conversation, those kind of, I was struck by the your comment about, you know, Peter, you said that the gig economy is real, kind of. You're not convinced it's completely
real. Oh, I think it's real. But what I was saying is I'm not sure how big an impact it's going to have on traditional staffing.
Yeah.
You know, I think the jury's still out on that. I know my friend Tony does.
Well, let me give you an example. So we did an interesting story not too long ago about a major, food service company. And the biggest number one challenge that they have is that hourly people they have hired, don't show up day one.
Right.
That's number one. If you think about it from a gig economy standpoint, kind of an Uber thing, through smart scheduling, through smart software, maybe you alleviate that by setting it up in a gig economy and saying, okay, you can work, what in the coming week, you work, 14 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours there. Won't work for everyone, but it's a strategy that more folks are looking at pretty seriously because it gives people the flexibility and the freedom that they're looking for who embrace the gig economy.
Right.
And that is a growing percentage of the workforce.
Right. And and there's nothing cooler than you get your phone and 4 minutes later,
right,
your Uber driver is at the hotel, 2 hour delivery in some part, in Amazon. I mean, it's almost like, we can't wait for a thing. Right. But there are some really deep implications. I think that there's policy issues.
Mm-hmm.
There are,
compliance
issues. And yet it seems to be, I told you I had a follow-up question, but here's the other side. Is the gig economy, does it really exist because that's what people want, or does it exist because that's all that's really available? And because if you look at one side of it, there is a cadre of people who definitely love that free, the freedom and flexibility of lifestyle, but there's also this huge conversation behind it about wage inequity, safety, all those kind of things. So you guys have a take on that question?
Well, I'll give you mine. I haven't seen great research on it. We're looking for it. But we're in an economy right now that the talent shortages are severe. And I know that there are skill levels where people still have difficulty finding positions.
Right.
But we're at a position right now where that's probably the lowest level it's been in some time.
Mm-hmm.
So the opportunity for someone to have the freedom and flexibility is probably greater now than it's been. And so the percentage of people who say, I think it was Lyft that came out with this research about a year ago, said the percentage of people who are looking for part-time employment so that they can pursue what they really want to do is much higher than most people believe. And I don't remember the stats off the top of my head, but
yeah,
higher and getting higher. And it's the cobbling together of the gig economy. It's the ability to, I'm going to drive Uber this many hours. I am going to do, pet care and dog walking or whatever it might be. And that's a stereotypical type of job.
Mm-hmm.
There are much more sophisticated jobs, but whatever it is,
mm-hmm,
but the most important one is, and I'm taking off next week because I'm going with my buddy skiing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the work, like flexibility.
Absolutely.
kind of practice.
And you make it, still make enough to live on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I would respectfully disagree.
Okay.
And only because, at least there's one data point, and granted, it's not a trend, but in the most recent BLS data that came out, we saw an increase in, or a fairly substantial number of jobs filled, new hires, and at the same time, an increase in the unemployment rate, which meant that more key people came back into the labor market.
Mm-hmm.
And that would suggest to me that at least some people who've been sitting on the sidelines in the gig economy, really not doing it because it is a lifestyle choice. They're doing it because it is an economic requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so sure that the fundamental nature of what people want, the flexibility and so forth, isn't going to change as they get older, as they have mortgage requirements and college tuition requirements and so forth. I mean, these are the very same issues that we covered when we were reading about the free agent nation.
Right.
That was going to be the whole new way we're going to live. I am not convinced at this point. I agree with Tony that it does offer employers a very creative way to deal with talent shortages, and that's something that they should explore. And as he pointed out, there are people, pediatric nurses and scientists and engineers, who want to be gig workers, not just
right,
Uber drivers and so forth. So I do think employers ought to be looking at that. But whether the number of people in the workforce actually has gone up, the number of people who want to be in that economy, I think the data, the jury's still out.
Yeah, and you hear, you hear all this different data. Like at this conference somewhere, I heard that one of the most important things to workers today is job security, which is not really, it consistent. I want to be a freelancer, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's kind of, it's based on your skills, and what your outcome or your intention of life is, mm-hmm. to your point, age, I think.
And it's generational too. I mean, you know, as you say, people will grow out of it, but there's still a large percentage of people who are in that millennial generation and even Gen Z mm-hmm. coming up who will embrace it for a period as long as they can. And then, you know, life changes.
But I think you're defining job security maybe in an older fashioned.
Right, I'm a boomer, right.
So when
you hear job security, that's what, I've never had a job anywhere more than 7 years, but I know some people in companies I work for who worked there for 50 years.
So lifetime employment is not the definition that I use, but I think it means something different, right?
To all of us here, when we think job security, we think working. I really do believe the gig economy is big. It will be big. And I think job security means I can work in lots of different gigs.
Mm-hmm.
So just the definition is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
But it's here to stay.
So if you're a freelancer with either a ready supply of customers to come back to you for repeat work, or you're a freelancer who goes from project to the next, what you're saying, I think, is that would meet the job
that
security. As long as I can earn the money I need.
It's needed for me.
Right.
But it's good for my children. You
right.
know, it's just a different generation.
Well, by the way, I describe it as, you know, my parents' generation went to work for a General, right? General Mills, General Dynamics, General Motors, right? And you work there 40, 50 years, you get the watch, the pension, then you're done.
Right.
Now, job security is no longer on the company, right? It's on us. And it's on us to manage our skills, our network, and our reputation,
mm-hmm.
right? And a lot of other things, right? And so I think that's what's happening is as people have opportunities to maybe have a balance of life, by doing different mm-hmm. jobs and going on vacation when they want, working from where they want, in what clothes they want. You know, they never want to go back. A lot of them never want to go back from that.
Right.
You know, I mean, I worked in corporate at Price Waterhouse for 7 years, Accenture for 3 years. I've been in an environment, it's a great environment. But now, after 17 years, I couldn't go back.
Right.
I couldn't go back into an office every day. I mean, we go to clients every day and they show us their cool offices. We walk around thinking, boy, I'm so glad I don't
have to.
Cool. That's a great foosball machine, but right.
So, well, and it may be, pardon me, Carol.
No, yeah, go ahead.
But it may be that gig economy will not be a choice. By that I mean, if you look at some of the more recent studies about the use of technology to basically replace humans.
Right.
The number of jobs that are going to be available, even in very sophisticated fields. I mean, the law field has been, legal field's already been decimated because all of the research that used to be done by young associates is now done by technology. And you have even physicians and nurses being replaced by technology. So we may be in the situation where we have to work part-time because the machine is taking away the full-time job. Right?
Yeah. So part of what I was going to say is, so part of the problem with that perspective, not your perspective, just the gig economy perspective, right? You know, work implies sort of a social contract. It was, you know, and of course that got screwed up by lawyers, you know, all this kind of stuff. But the companies today, right, the meeting global demand, agility to be able to flex, you know, you guys get, you know, busy at Christmas or whatever it is at Amazon. You want to be able to jack your workforce up and then cut it back to meet your demand. But that puts people, because this is the other part that we talk about, right? How people, the experience, that puts people sort of in a hard place sometimes, I think. And I don't know how companies answer that question, right? How do you employ people only when you need them and then say, come on back, you're welcome back for 3 months. So GM used to do it with layoffs. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you do it? How do companies do it today?
Yeah, UPS. UPS hires, you know, 100,000 people around the holidays, right? To bring trucks.
Right.
And they say, thank you, now go away.
And that's the deal, too, right?
And talent on demand.
Right. And that hires a lot of part-timers and pays full-time benefits. And, you know, there's a lot of challenge. But so it's a challenge of the economy and the global economy versus how do you treat people fairly, right? It's tough. The other thing that you guys talked about, I think, because we're about let me do this reset, and we're about 20 minutes in. So this is Mike Vandervoort. We're doing drive-through HR today from Sherm Talent in Orlando, and I have a panel of guests. Just did a panel on top trends in talent acquisition. So we have Tom Dero, Tony Lee, Peter Weddle, and Dan Monahan. Thank you. do it on the fly, but I got them. And we're talking kind of around some issues from the panel and a few other things. personal touch. That was one of the things that came up, right? Optimize your mobile strategy, but you still really need to work on the personal touch. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, we were talking about it also in looking at companies growing very fast. How do you scale out? And, when you scale, you have to automate. And how much automation do you do? And at the end of the day, we're dealing with people, we're dealing with families. So you have to build you can scale out your automation fantastically. There's got to be personal touch somewhere. And then you have to be people who care.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else have a thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just add that, I think where this came from, because actually almost all the panelists mentioned it in one way or another, was that technology can replace talent acquisition, easily. It's already doing it. But if you allow that to happen, then, you're going to run that risk of the folks who accept the offer and then don't show up because it's only about the money or it's only about, the best job in persuading them that this is the right opportunity. So you've got to have that personal touch to make sure the person feels connected. They feel like they're part of something more important than what they were doing before. And it keeps them in as well as bringing them in.
The other thing that I was thinking, I said there were a couple of duh moments. And the other duh moment I had is that your panel member that isn't here.
Nicole.
Yeah. Nicole said, all my recruiters have smartphones. And I was like, head, who doesn't, right? But then she followed up with that, which what I thought was a very astute comment, which explains where she was going, which she said email is really not the way people want to communicate today, and rather the candidates want to be texted to. And I don't do recruiting, so I mean that's obvious as a user of communication, but it's not so obvious
it's revolutionary in talent acquisition, because I can tell you the vendors don't offer it. I mean, it's
unbelievable, right? The open rates are much, much greater with text. But we recently did a global survey of job boards. We had about 250 participate, and we asked them about trends and issues and product offerings and so forth. And a very small percentage of job boards currently offer a job alert via text. They're still doing it by email, and then they don't understand why the response rate is so low. So it's just the next step in reaching out, providing that human contact that you were talking about. But I would also add that there's a hidden challenge here, and that is we have to be careful not to make that human touch. For example, if we're talking about mobilizing our corporate career site, to just simply take what we're doing on something that was developed for the PC and we're switching it over to a phone.
Press it down.
We need to have a native experience to the phone so that it actually feels like a human touch,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just, using some sort of code so that it still looks nice when you come out on a smartphone.
Somebody that was, and it was last night actually at your reception, which we crashed. Thank you for the beer.
And we were happy.
Someone there, and it's not the name is informed, but somebody was talking about that they work in from a much more of a marketing perspective than they do a recruiting perspective. And his, for example, I don't understand why recruiters don't have instant message and chat on their employment brand pages, right? And I was like, again, kind of like, I hadn't really thought about it, but I think that, that creates that it's a robot, and you can actually talk to somebody. So there's a lot of challenges to create that kind of environment, right? I mean, you guys do it with your customer service, so you could theoretically do an employment brand, but would it be something that you could ever see Amazon doing? Do you do it now?
I don't do it now. We've talked about it a lot. I do see us doing it. There are challenges. Their time zone challenge. I mean, there are challenges in doing it, but there's no reason not to.
Yeah, when people first started doing customer service on Twitter, Delta Airlines is open from like 8 to 5. And I was like, come on, you're not 8 to 5 business. I can't tweet you at 4, 8, 8 p.m. and have you answer me tomorrow, and it won't do me any good since it changed. I guess there was one thing. Sorry, I got to scan my notes. It was simplifying job applications. But again, at your reception last night, apparently there was quite a lot of discussion at PA Tech about not just simplifying, but perhaps either killing the resume or that it's dead, right? So the videos, you know, whether it's your LinkedIn profile or whatever. So, do we get rid of resumes? That's the first question. And then if we don't get rid of them, what's the future of resumes and applications?
Well, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, can we not have a resume since I had hair? And
right.
since
mine was dark, right? Yeah.
So I'm a little cynical about that. But I do think where we are moving is that there will be cloud-based data profiles about that individuals report with them. We talked, one of the things that Tony brought up was the huge drop-off rate when people go to apply on corporate career sites.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get the application form. And part of that is because I just filled out a similar form that took me 25 minutes on some other employer site. I'm exhausted. I don't want to do it again. And part of it is because the form is 19 pages long. But the technology is simple enough so that the data can be transferred consistently in the majority of the fields. There will obviously be idiosyncratic questions to every organization, but we can make the load on the individual much lower so that he or she can really focus on the important questions that the employer is asking. And that may well end up being the resume of the future, transfer of data as opposed to what we think of as a paper, even electronic version of a career
record. Linen, 12-point font, all that little stuff. And yet some employers, we won't name the name, but some employers find value in a long application process.
Well, some do. There's one company I'm thinking of that has a 19-page employment application, if you would print it out. Now it's online. But they're right now, they want information about the person. And secondly, they want to see if they fill it out. Because if they feel like if they don't have the attitude to fully fill it out, then what kind of attitude will they have if a customer comes up to the counter or through the drive-thru and is angry, right, or has some issue? And this particular restaurant is well-known for their customer service, and, it doesn't just happen. It happens because of the people they hire, how they train them,
their culture, and it runs all the way through the experience.
Yeah.
And many companies that are successful have similar.
Right.
We've talked about this also for years and years and years. I don't know how in a super strong economy, how you can expect top talent to sit down and fill out an application for an hour, however long it takes.
Right.
I think that's not my approach. It could be for certain industries, but I hire a lot of tech people, and they have multiple job offers without doing much. So we have to go after them. They won't apply, or if they apply, it literally is name, last name, email, and then maybe one of these social media links.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we can gather everything about them. We can suck it off the internet and build a profile, but that's how we hire really good talent. They will not sit through a process of doing applications. Now, of course,
they have the luxury to some extent because of their skill set to pick and choose versus who's applying at a movie theater or a restaurant or grocery store.
Theoretically, yes, but I think they are.
You think it could apply in a less technical kind of environment?
I think capture the talent pool and then weed them out. Versus reading them out, and you never capture the good.
I agree with that. Okay. We're down to our last minute and 20 seconds or so. We said we'd do a 30-minute show. First of all, I want to thank all of you. I know doing a panel and then coming in and doing a radio show in a conference room over the computer is a little bit different. So thanks all of you for being here. Tony, I wanted you to get a chance to talk about just real quickly about the work Sherm's doing with talent acquisition. If we close with that, is that okay?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. Sherm kind of lost focus on talent acquisition. And one of the things that we've really pushing hard is to bring that focus back. And so we've done a number of things. We have a new talent acquisition email newsletter that everyone can sign up
and
for.
I subscribe to it. It's great.
Thank you. And you just go to sherm.org and hit publications and hit newsletters and you can sign up. And we've got a dedicated full-time reporter who's writing about nothing but talent acquisition. He's here. He's talked to many of the folks. So HR Magazine's got more articles. So we're just expanding what we're doing. And I think this conference is an example. We have more sessions, significantly more sessions on talent acquisition than we've ever had. And so, you know, we feel the need to help, you know, SHRM members with their talent acquisition needs. And so we want to be that resource.
Great. Well, thanks to all of you again for being on Drive-Thru HR today. I'm going to see if I can get a little bit of music to play, and then we're going to take the show out. So let me see. There's always so many great choices.
You could do YouTube in honor of our morning speaker.
Yeah, and then the very question is whether it plays or not. So thanks a lot. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow afternoon sometime on that. That is, have a great day.